This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present The Throne of Caesar by Stephen Saylor. Narrated by John Curlis. Day 1. March 10th. Chapter 1. Once upon a time, a young slave came to fetch me on a warm spring morning. That was the first time I met Tyro. Many years later, he came to fetch me again. But now he was a freedman, no longer a slave. The month was Martius, and the morning was quite chilly, and we were both much older. Just how old was Tyro? My head was muddled by last night's wine, but not so muddled that I couldn't do the math. Tyro was 7 years younger than I. That made him 59. Tyro, nearly 60. How was that possible? Could 36 years have passed since the first time he came to my door? On that occasion, Tyro was still a slave, though a very well-educated one. He was the private secretary and right-hand man of his master, an obscure young advocate by the name of Cicero, who was just starting his career in Rome. All these years later, everyone in Rome knew of Cicero. He was as famous as Cato or Pompey, and still alive, which they were not. Cicero was almost as famous as our esteemed dictator. Almost, I say, because no one could ever be as famous as Caesar, or as powerful, or as rich. There was a dictator ruling Rome on that occasion, too, I muttered to myself. What's that, Gordianus? Asked Tyro, who had followed me through the atrium, down a dim hallway and into the garden at the centre of the house. Nothing was blooming yet, but patches of greenery shimmered in the morning sunlight. Crouching by the small fish pond, Bast, the latest in a long line of cats to bear that name, stared up at a bird that sang a pleasant song from a safe perch on a roof tile. I felt the faintest breath of spring in the chilly morning air. I wrapped my cloak around me, sat on a wooden bench that caught the morning sunlight, and leaned back against one of the columns of the peristyle. Tyro sat on a bench nearby, facing me. I took a good look at him. He had been a handsome youth. He was still handsome, despite his years. Now, as then, his eyes were his most arresting feature. They were an unusual colour, a pale shade of lavender, made all the more striking by the frame of his meticulously barbered white curls. "I was just saying, Tyro," I rubbed my temples, trying to soothe the stabbing pain in my head. "There was a dictator ruling Rome on that occasion, too. How old were you then? When? The first time I met you. Oh, let me think. I must have been 23. Yeah, that's right. Cicero was 26. And I was 30. I was recalling that occasion. It wasn't at this house, of course. I was still living in that ramshackle place I inherited from my father over on the Esquiline Hill, not here on the Palatine. And it was a warm day, the month of Maius, wasn't it? Then, as now, I answered the knock at the door myself, something my wife insists I should never do, since we have a slave for just that purpose. And, seeing you today at my front door, I had that feeling. A feeling? Oh, you know, we all feel it now and again, that uncanny sensation that one has experienced something before, A shivery feeling. Ah, yes, I know the phenomenon. One experiences it less as one grows older. I wonder why that is. And I wonder why we have no word for it in Latin. Perhaps you or Cicero should invent one. Already seen, or some other compound, or borrow a word from some other language. The Etruscans had a word for it, I think. Did they? Tyro raised an eyebrow. There was a mischievous glint in his lavender eyes. Yes, it will come to me. Or was it the Carthaginians? A pity we made Punic a dead language before plundering all the useful words. Oh, but my head is such a muddle this morning. Because you drank too much last night. I looked at him askance. Why do you say that? The way you look, the way you walk, the way you sat down and leaned back against that column so gingerly, as if that thing on your shoulders were an egg that might crack. It was true. My temples rolled with thunder. Spidery traces of lightning flashed and vanished just beyond the corners of my eyes. Last night's wine was to blame. Tyro laughed. You had a hangover on that morning, all those many years ago. Did I? Oh, yes, I remember, because you taught me the cure for a hangover. I did? What was it? I could use it now. You must remember. I'm an old man, Tyro, I forget things. But you've been doing it ever since I got here. Asking questions. Trying to think of a word. Thinking. That's the cure. Ah, yes. I seem to have a vague recollection. You had a very elegant explanation, I remember, because later I wrote it down, thinking Cicero might be able to use it in a speech or a treatise some day. I quote, "Thought, according to some physicians, takes place in the brain, lubricated by the secretion of phlegm. When the phlegm becomes polluted or hardened, the result is a headache. But the actual activity of thought produces fresh phlegm to soften and disperse the old. So, the more intently one thinks, the greater the production of phlegm. Therefore, intense concentration will speed along the natural recovery from a hangover by flushing the humours from the inflamed tissue and restoring the lubrication of the membranes." By Hercules, what a memory you have! Tyro was famous for it. Cicero could dictate a letter, and a year later Tyro could quote it back to him verbatim. And, by Hercules, what a lot of rubbish I used to talk! I shook my head. And still do? What? Had Tyro still been a slave, such a remark would have been impertinent. He had acquired a sharp tongue to match his sharp wits. "I call your bluff, Gordianus." "What bluff?" "About that Etruscan word, the one that just happens to escape you. I don't believe any such word exists. I wish I had a denarius for every time I've heard someone say, 'The Etruscans had a word for it,' or 'that the Etruscans invented this or that old saying, or this or that odd custom.' Such assertions are almost invariably nonsense. Things Etruscan are old and quaint, and hardly anyone speaks the language any more, except the Haruspices who perform the fatidic rites. A few villagers in the middle of nowhere, and a handful of crusty old dabblers in forgotten lore. Etruscan customs and words are therefore mysterious, and exert a certain mystique. But it's intellectually lazy to impute a saying or custom to the Etruscans, when there's no evidence whatsoever for such an assertion. Even so, I'm pretty sure the Etruscans had a word. Then I challenge you, Gordianus, to come up with that word by the last day of Martius. No, sooner. By the day you turn 66. That's on the 23rd day of the month, yes? Now you're showing off, Tyro. But as for this word, I suspect it will come to me before you leave my house. And if you continue to vex me so, that may be sooner rather than later. I said this with a smile, for I was actually quite glad to see him. I had always been fond of Tyro, if not of his erstwhile master, on whose behalf almost surely Tyro had come to see me. Lightning again flashed in my temples, causing me to wince. This cure seems not to be working as well as it did when I was younger, perhaps because my wits are not as sharp as they used to be. "Whose are?" asked Tyro, with a sigh. "Or perhaps I'm drinking more than I used to. Too many long winter nights at the salacious tavern spent in dubious company, to the dreaded displeasure of my wife and daughter. Ah, wait, I remember now. Not that elusive Etruscan word, but the little game of mental gymnastics I played with you the first time we met, which not only cured my hangover, but quite impressed you with my powers of deduction." "That's right, Gordianus. You correctly deduced the exact reason I'd come to see you. And I can do the same thing today." Tyro folded his arms across his chest and gave me a challenging look. He was about to speak when he was interrupted by Diana, who stepped from the shadows of the portico into the sunlight. "I can do likewise," said my daughter. Tyro looked a bit flustered as he stood to greet the newcomer. He cocked his head. "Now I'm the one who's having that feeling, that eerie sensation we need a word for. Because on the morning we first met, Gordianus, surely this very same ravishing female appeared from nowhere and took my breath away. But how can that be? Truly, it's as if I've stepped back in time." I smiled. "That was Bethesda who joined us that morning. This is her daughter. Our daughter, Diana." Diana accepted Tyro's compliment without comment, and why not? She was ravishing, breathtaking, in fact, just as her mother had been, with thick, shimmering black hair, bright eyes, and a shapely figure that even her matronly stola did little to conceal. She raised an eyebrow and gave me a disapproving glance. "Did you answer the door yourself, Papa? You know we have a slave for that." "You sound like your mother, too," I laughed. "But you were just saying that you could deduce the reason for Tyro's visit. Do proceed." "Very well. First, who sent Tyro?" She peered at him so intently that he blushed. Tyro had always been shy around beautiful women. "Well, that's easy. Marcus Tullius Cicero, of course." "Who says that anyone sent me?" objected Tyro. "I'm a free citizen." "Yes, you could have come to visit my father on your own initiative, but you never do. Though he invariably enjoys your company, you contact him only when Cicero asks you to." Tyro blushed again. A red-faced youth is charming. A red-faced man, nearly 60, looks rather alarming. But his laugh reassured me. "As a matter of fact, you're right. I came here at Cicero's behest." Diana nodded. "And why has Cicero sent you?" "Well, almost certainly it has something to do with the dictator." "Why do you say that?" asked Tyro. "Because anything and everything that happens nowadays has something to do with Julius Caesar." "You're correct," conceded Tyro. "But you'll have to be more specific if you want to impress me." "Or if you want to impress me," I added. "Diana was always seeking to demonstrate to me her powers of ratiocination. This was part of her ongoing campaign to convince me that she should be allowed to carry on the family profession. My father and I had both been called the finder in our respective generations, to which my invariable response was that a 25-year-old Roman matron with 2 children to raise, no matter how clever she might be, had no business sorting out clues and solving crimes and otherwise sticking her nose into dangerous people's business. Go on, daughter. Tell us, if you can, why Cicero sent Tyro to fetch me this morning. Diana shut her eyes and pressed her fingertips to her temples, elbows akimbo, as if channeling some mystic source of knowledge. The first time you met my father was in the 2nd year of Sulla's dictatorship. You came to ask for the finder's assistance to help Cicero uncover the truth behind a shocking crime, an unholy crime, vile, unspeakable, the murder of a father by his own son, parricide. Tyro made a scoffing sound, but in fact he looked a bit unnerved by Diana's mystic pose. Well, it's no secret that the defence of Sextus Roscius was Cicero's first major trial, remembered by everyone who was in Rome at the time. Obviously your father has told you about his own role in the investigation. No, Tyro, let her go on, I said, captivated despite myself by Diana's performance. Her eyelids flickered, and her voice dropped in pitch. Now you come again to ask for my father's help in this, the 5th year of Caesar's dictatorship. Again, it's about a crime, but a crime that has yet to be committed. A crime even more shocking than the murder of Sextus Roscius, and even more unholy, vile, unspeakable. The murder of another father by his children. No, 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 said Tyro, shaking his head a bit too insistently. Oh, yes, declared Diana, her eyes still flickering. For hasn't the intended victim been named Father of the Fatherland, so that any Roman who dared to kill him would be a parricide? And hasn't every senator taken a vow to protect this man's life with his very own, so that any senator who raised a hand against him would be committing sacrilege? Tyro opened his mouth, dumbfounded. Isn't this the reason you've come here today, Tyro? Said Diana, opening her eyes and staring into his. You want the finder to come to Cicero and reveal to him whatever he may know or be able to discover regarding the plot to murder the dictator, the father of the fatherland, the conspiracy to assassinate Gaius Julius Caesar. Chapter 2 Tyro looked from Diana to me and back again. But how could either of you possibly... Has someone been spying on Cicero and me? And what is this plot you speak of? What do you know about... Diana threw back her head and laughed, delighted by his reaction. I clicked my tongue. Really, daughter, it's unkind of you to disconcert our guest. Is there a plot against Caesar or isn't there? Said Tyro. His worldly commanding presence fell away, and I had a glimpse of him as I had first seen him all those many years ago, bright and eager, but easily alarmed, easily impressed. I sighed. I'm afraid my daughter has seen her father pull such tricks on visitors too many times over the years, and she can't resist doing so herself. No, Tyro. There's no plot to murder Caesar, at least none that I know of, and Diana certainly knows no more than I do. Or do you, Diana? Of course I don't, Papa. How could I possibly know more than you do about what's going on out there in the big bad world? She batted her eyes and put on a blank expression. Many times over the years I have been made aware that women, despite the constraints of their sheltered existence, do in fact have ways of discovering things that remain unknown and mysterious, even to the fathers and husbands who rule over them. I could never be sure exactly what Diana knew, or how she came to know it. I cleared my throat. I suspect that my daughter simply followed a line of reasoning, taking her cues from your reactions, which are as easy to read now as when you were a youth. Add to her capacity for deduction a certain degree of intuition, inherited from her mother, and you begin to see how Diana was able, essentially, to read your mind. Tyro frowned. Even so, I never said a word about any sort of conspiracy. You never had to. We had already established that your visit had something to do with the dictator. Now what could that be, and why come to me? To be sure, I have a link to Caesar. My son Mito is quite close to him. Over the years, he's helped the dictator write his memoirs. Mito will continue to do so when he leaves Rome before the end of the month, when the dictator heads off to conquer Parthia. Could it be that Cicero is so eager to know when the next volume of Caesar's memoirs will be published that he would call me to his house to ask me? I think not. And as for anything to do with Caesar or the Parthian campaign, that isn't already common knowledge. Well, Cicero knows that I would never let slip anything Mito might have told me in confidence. So, what is this concern of Cicero's having to do with Caesar, and why summon me? Most likely, it's something to do with crime or conspiracy. Those are the areas where my skills and his interests have intersected in the past. But what crime? What conspiracy? If this were 10 years ago, or even 5, I'd presume that Cicero was mounting a defense for an upcoming trial. But there are no trials any longer, not in the old-fashioned sense. All courts are under the jurisdiction of the dictator, and everyone knows that poor Cicero's voice has grown rusty with no speeches to give in the Senate or orations to deliver at a trial. They say he spends his time reading obscure old texts and writing yet more texts for lovers of abstruse lore to pore over in the distant future. What is Cicero working on now, Tyro? Oh, he's very nearly finished with his treatise on divination. It's going to be the standard text for any... Ha! It's no wonder you're up on your Etruscan vocabulary, if you've been helping Cicero translate texts on haruspicy. Well, I doubt that Cicero wants to pick my brain about such matters, since I know no more about divination than the average Roman. Actually, Papa, I suspect you know more than you realize, said Diana. Kind words, daughter. Nevertheless, I think we are back to crime or conspiracy. Who has not heard the rumors flitting about Rome the last couple of months? Rumors that someone intends to kill Caesar. But how credible are such rumors? Certainly, after so many years of bloodshed and civil war, there must be quite a few citizens who would like to see our dictator dead. But who are they? How many are out there? Is it only a disgruntled senator or two? Or is Rome full of such men? Do they have the will and the capacity to act? Do they have time to act? Because once Caesar leaves for Parthia, each day will take him farther and farther from Rome. A general on campaign, surrounded by hand-picked officers every minute of the day, virtually impossible to kill. Is there or is there not a plot afoot to kill Caesar? That's a question Cicero must have on his mind these days. It's on my mind as well. After so much suffering in the past few years, we all wonder what the future might hold. And no Roman can imagine the future now without taking Caesar into account, one way or another. The death of Caesar, well, it's almost unthinkable. Or is it? Tyro made no answer. He was looking across the pond at Bast, staring at the unmoving cat that crouched and stared at a twittering bird on a roof tile. Or, I continued, struck by a terrible thought, I suppose it could be that Cicero is part of such a conspiracy, and he thinks he might be able to recruit me. "Certainly not," protested Tyro. He gave such a start that the bird flitted off and the cat bolted away, its claws scraping the paving stones. "Cicero's most certainly not involved in any plot to harm the dictator," he said, so distinctly it was almost as if he feared some spy might be listening to us. "But he nevertheless thinks that I might know something in this regard," I said. "I suppose that makes sense. My son Mito might have let slip some detail arising from Caesar's own network of informers, but I would never share such privileged intelligence with Cicero, or with anyone else." Tyro sighed. "Even so, Gordianus, Cicero very much wants to talk to you. Won't you come? As a favour to me, if not to him." Diana took a step closer. "Perhaps we should go, Papa." "We? Oh, no, you won't be coming along, dear daughter, though I suppose I should take that hulking husband of yours for a bodyguard. Would you fetch Davis for me, Diana?" "But, Papa..." As if to illustrate where her priority should lie, her two children suddenly joined us. Aulus hurtled straight toward me. Little Beth toddled after him. I gathered my arms around them and sat one on each knee, groaning at the weight. Beth was still tiny, but at the age of 7, Aulus was getting bigger every day. Perhaps he would grow to be as big as his father. The children's nursemaid appeared, a look of chagrin on her wrinkled face.
"Oh, apologies, mistress, apologies, master. I don't seem to have enough hands to hold the two of them when they're determined to run to their grandfather."
"It's no bother, Macris," I said. "You would need as many arms as a hydra has heads to hold these two in check." I glanced at Tyro and saw a wistful look on his face. Whatever else the fates had given him, a good master, then freedom, then a considerable degree of prestige and the respect of his fellow citizens, they hadn't given him progeny.
"But, Papa, surely we should offer refreshments to your guest," said Diana.
"Morning refreshment will be supplied, but by Cicero, not by me. Quit stalling, daughter, and fetch Davis."
"It's such a short walk," said Tyro, standing up. "My own bodyguard is waiting for us outside. Later, he can walk you home."
"Then how would Davis report to Diana all he sees and hears?" "Yes, daughter, I know you dream that the two of you should some day work as a team, you the brains, him the brawn." Diana made a grunt of exasperation, then went to find her husband. "I trust that Cicero will supply refreshment," I said to Tyro as I gently ejected the children from my knees, one at a time. "I have cause for celebration."
"What's that?"
"My hangover is cured."
Chapter 3.
When first we met, I had lived on the Esquiline Hill, and Cicero near the Capitoline Hill. To visit him, I had to traverse both the Subura, Rome's roughest neighbourhood, and much of the Forum, the heart of Rome, with its splendid temples and magnificent public spaces. Since then, we had both moved up in the world. My house and his were both on the Palatine Hill, Rome's most exclusive area. We were practically neighbours. At one point, during the short walk, I had a clear view of the top of the Capitoline Hill to the north, crowned by the Temple of Jupiter, one of the most imposing structures on earth. In a prominent place before the temple stood a bronze statue. Though the features were indistinct at such a great distance, I knew the statue well, having seen it unveiled on the day of Caesar's Gallic triumph. Standing atop a map of the world, striking a victorious pose and looking down on the Roman Forum below, stood not a mere mortal, but a demigod. So declared the inscription on the pedestal, which listed Caesar's many titles, ending with the declaration, "Descendant of Venus, demigod." The statue was visible from virtually every part of the city. "And who would dare to kill a demigod?" I muttered.
"What's that?" said Tyro.
"Nothing, talking to myself again, something I seem to do quite often these days." As we approached Cicero's house, I saw a brutish-looking guard standing outside the front door, a man with a face that could frighten small children to tears. My son-in-law nudged me and indicated another watchman pacing the roof. He and Davis acknowledged each other with small nods, as neutral bodyguards do. The guard at the door nodded to Tyro, kicked the door with his heel, and stepped aside. Not a word was spoken, yet the door opened for us the moment Tyro set foot on the stone threshold. There was yet another guard in the vestibule. The slave who had opened the door and closed it behind us remained out of sight, as if invisible. Cicero had developed a mania for security over the years. Who could blame him? At the peak of his political career, the tide had turned so viciously against him that he was driven into exile. His previous house on the Palatine had been burned to the ground. Eventually, his exile was rescinded by the Senate, and he was welcomed back. He moved into another house on the Palatine, and then was forced to flee the city when Caesar crossed the Rubicon and headed for Rome with an army. I vividly remembered visiting him the day he frantically packed his most precious scrolls and valuables, lost in a haze of despair. Now Cicero was back in Rome, pardoned by the dictator, but clearly uncertain of the future and braced for any new reversal of fortune. I spared a glance at the wax masks of Cicero's ancestors in the niches of the vestibule, which unblinkingly watched everyone who came and went. They were a stern-looking bunch, and not very handsome. Some of them exhibited the chickpea-like cleft nose that had earned the family's distinctive cognomen. Leaving his own bodyguard behind in the vestibule, Tyro led Davis and me past the shallow pool of the atrium and down a hallway to Cicero's library. Tyro entered the room first. Cicero, seated and clutching a metal stylus and a wax tablet, hardly looked up. He appeared not to notice that Davis and I had also entered the room.
"Tyro, thank Jupiter you're back. I've been struggling with this passage ever since you left. Here, tell me what you think." "Why, the very word fate is full of superstition and old women's credulity. For if all things happen by fate, it does us no good to be warned to be on our guard, since that which is to happen will happen, regardless of what we do. But if that which is to be can be turned aside, there's no such thing as fate. So, too, there can be no such thing as divination, since divination deals with things that are going to happen. There. Is it clear enough?
Even I can understand it, I said.
Gordianus! Cicero finally noticed me and flashed a broad smile. And he frowned as he tried to think of the name. Davis, isn't it? By Hercules, you're a strapping fellow, aren't you?
Davis grunted at a loss for words, as he often was.
You needn't say anything, son-in-law, I said. That's called a rhetorical question and requires no reply.
Cicero laughed and put down his stylus and tablet.
Teaching him rhetoric, are you? Alas, too late, since there's no use for it any more. Please, all of you, take a seat.
A pair of young slaves produced chairs from various corners of the cluttered space, and then, at a signal from their master, left the room.
You seem to be in a good mood, I said, genuinely surprised.
When I had last seen him, Cicero had the consolation of a teenage bride to distract him from the sorry state of the Republic, but that marriage had ended in divorce. Another blow had occurred at about the same time, when the light of his life, his beloved daughter Tullia, died in childbirth. On this Martius morning, he seemed unaccountably cheerful.
"Then why not?" he said. "Spring is almost here. Can't you feel it in the air? And at long last I have the time and resources to do what I've wanted to do all my life, write books."
"You've always written."
"Oh, a trifle here and there, speeches and such. But I mean real books, long philosophic tracts and discourses, books that will stand the test of time. There was never opportunity for that kind of writing when I was busy in the law courts and the Senate, and certainly not when I was away from Rome, slogging from camp to camp, marching with Pompey to save the Republic. Alas, alas!"
He sighed, then reached for another tablet. There were a great many of these stacked on small tables and tucked amid the shelves that housed the hundreds of scrolls that made up Cicero's library. Apparently, he jotted down any idea that occurred to him, and he needed many tablets. Grudgingly, I had to admire his ability to stay busy and find purpose after all the disappointments and disasters that had befallen him.
"Here, speaking of Pompey, listen to this,"
he read aloud.
"Even if we could foretell the future, would we wish to do so? Would Pompey have found joy in his three consulships, his three triumphs, and the fame of his transcendent deeds, if he had known that he would be driven from Rome, lose his army, and then be slain like a dog in an Egyptian desert, and that following his death, those terrible events would occur of which I cannot speak without tears?"
His voice quivered as he read the final words, but he smiled with satisfaction as he looked up.
"Not like a dog," said Tyro. "Too harsh." "Oh, should I remove it?"
Cicero peered at the tablet.
"Yes, of course you're right, Tyro, as you invariably are."
He scratched out the words with his stylus.
"Pompey was a true believer in portents and omens, you know. He placed great reliance on divination by those Etruscan heraspices who poke about entrails, looking for odd spots or growths on this organ or that. A lot of good it did him. And you, Gordianus, do you consort with heraspices?"
"I've known a heraspex or two in my time. There was
one particularly favoured by Caesar's wife?
Which wife?
Quipped Cicero. His ex-wife, his current wife, or his Egyptian whore across the Tiber? This last remark referred to Queen Cleopatra, who was making her second state visit to Rome and residing at Caesar's lavish garden estate outside the city. As far as I know, Caesar has only one wife, Calpurnia. I was somewhat acquainted with her favourite haruspex, Porsenna.
Oh, that unfortunate fellow! Reading entrails didn't save him from his sorry end, did it? More irony. Perhaps I should add his example to my discourse. She has another one now, you know.
I beg your pardon?
Calpurnia. She has another haruspex, hanging about her house, telling her which days are safe for Caesar to be out and about, especially since he stopped using his bodyguards. Not that Caesar himself pays any attention to Spurinna, but he did make the fellow a senator, if you can believe it, an Etruscan diviner in the Roman Senate. What would our forefathers make of that?
Cicero shook his head.
At least Spurinna comes from an old and distinguished Etruscan family. It's those other new members of the Senate who gall me. The Gauls, I mean. Outrageous!
With so many of the leading men of Rome killed in the civil war, the ranks of the Senate had been greatly depleted. To fill the chamber, Caesar had appointed hundreds of new senators, rewarding his supporters and allies, and not just men of Roman blood. With roughly half of the 800 or so senators appointed by Caesar, many of the older members complained that Caesar had rigged the odds, making sure that any vote in the Senate would be in his favour now and for the foreseeable future. How better to avoid another civil war, Mito had said to me, defending the man who was his commander and mentor, and now everyone's dictator.
So you're not a believer in divination? I asked. Gordianus, how long have you known me? Second sight? Soothsaying? Mind-reading? Fortune-telling? Seers and portents and oracles? You know I have no faith whatsoever in such things.
So your discourse debunks divination?
Ruthlessly. Of course. At the end, I have to express some support for it, as a tool of political expediency, in order that we may have a state religion. How do we decide to put it, Tyro?
Tyro quoted,
"However, out of respect for the opinion of the masses and because of the great service to the state, we maintain the augural practices, discipline, religious rites and laws, as well as the authority of the augural college."
Of course, that refers to Roman rites of divination, not the Etruscan rites. That was Cicero, I thought, always slippery with words, whether arguing in the law courts or writing a scholarly treatise. He'd been the same when choosing between Caesar and Pompey, waiting until the last possible moment, and then joining the losing side. That mistake had made him more cautious than ever. What did he really want from me? The moment hadn't yet come to press him about that.
Perhaps we might have refreshment?
Of course! What am I thinking, making you sit there with empty hands and empty stomachs?
Tyro, can you see to that?
Tyro nodded and slipped out of the room.
Ah, yes, Pompey and his superstitions, said Cicero. Cato was quite the opposite. Cato thought that haruspices were downright disreputable and also ridiculous, especially with those conical caps on their heads.
I supplied Cato's well-known quote. When one haruspex passes another in the street, it's a wonder that either one of them can keep a straight face. Cicero smiled wistfully. Alas, poor Cato! He fared no better than Pompey in the end. Cornered by Caesar's troops in Africa, like some beast of prey and driven to a messy suicide. By Hercules, I must include Cato's words somewhere in the treatise. He reached for his stylus and tablet, then put them down. Ah, but I've neglected one of my principal reasons for wanting to see you, Gordianus. To congratulate you. For what? It seemed to me I'd been doing very little lately, other than sitting in my wintry garden and making an occasional excursion to the salacious tavern and back. Please, Gordianus, you needn't be modest. I refer to the change in your status as a citizen, your elevation to the equestrian class. How in Hades do you know about that? From the postings in the forum. You know I dispatch a slave every day to peruse the lists, notifications of deaths and funerals, marriage announcements, and so on. When I was told that your name had appeared on the roster of new equestrians, I was delighted for you. I won't ask how you managed to accumulate that much wealth in the last year or two. Entirely by honest means, I assure you. Ah, well, there are plenty of men in Rome who got there by other ways. This was true. Many fortunes had been made as well as lost in the chaos of the civil war, often by shadowy means or outright crime. I had, in fact, come out of the war years better off than when they started, thanks to a particularly generous remuneration from none other than Calpurnia. For my hard work and discretion involving a matter that I had no intention of explaining to Cicero. Among Caesar's tools for restoring order was a canvassing of wealth. My good fortune hadn't gone unrecorded. Hence, my registration in the equestrian class, traditionally made up of wealthy merchants and landowners. When formally dressed in a toga, I had the right to wear underneath it a tunic with a narrow red stripe over the shoulder, not covered by the toga. By this visible red stripe, all men would know me as an equestrian. I hadn't yet bothered to obtain this garment. Members of the Roman Senate, a class defined more by power than wealth, wore a tunic with a broad red stripe, not a narrow one. A subtle but significant distinction. You should be very proud, Gordianus, when one thinks of how far you've come from your beginnings. I'm no better a man than my father was, I said brusquely. In fact, my father would have been delighted at my elevation in status, something he could never have dreamed of. As far as I can see, the honour has only drawbacks. I'll be made to pay more taxes and serve on committees, and maybe even on juries, if the legal system ever returns to normal. Have you thought of that word yet? Said Tyro, stepping back into the room. Two young female slaves followed him, one carrying a tray with pitchers of water and wine and cups, and the other carrying a tray of delicacies in silver bowls. I saw olives of many hues, dried dates and figs, and little honey cakes. Next to me I heard Davis's stomach growl. "What word?" I asked. "Oh, you mean that elusive Etruscan word for the universal sensation of having experienced this very moment at some previous time?" "A universal sensation?" asked Cicero. "Yes, everyone experiences it. Not me." "No, I have no idea what you're talking about. Ah, well, then you'll be of no help in coming up with that Etruscan word for it. So, perhaps we should move on to the reason you wanted to see me, other than congratulations on my dubious rise in the world. And what would that be? Asked Cicero, raising an eyebrow and glancing at Tyro, who raised an eyebrow back at him.
I didn't tell him, said Tyro. He guessed.
Actually, it was Diana, said Davis, speaking up to make sure his wife received due credit.
Yes, Cicero, I said. Shall we talk about the assassination of Julius Caesar?
Cicero blanched at hearing the words spoken so openly.
Was it that expression on his face, or the light in the room, or the disposition of the many coloured olives in their silver bowl, or something else altogether, that caused me in that very moment to experience the sensation I had just been talking about? Even as those brash words left my lips, some memory of the past, or premonition of the future, caused me to shiver and feel an icy chill down my spine.
Chapter 4
Cicero took a deep breath.
If you already know so very much, Gordianus, perhaps you also know about the warning that Spurinna, the Haruspex, delivered to Caesar less than a month ago.
I've heard the story, I said. In fact, my son, Mito, had told me, scoffing at every detail. It was on the first day the dictator appeared in public wearing purple robes and a laurel crown, seated on an ornately gilded chair. He had been voted these unprecedented honours by the Senate. No man had worn purple and sat on a throne in the Forum since the last of the hated kings were driven out and Rome became a republic more than 400 years ago. The dictator's regal trappings overshadowed the actual event, a religious rite at which an ox was sacrificed on the altar. The newly appointed Senator Spurinna, as presiding haruspex, examined the entrails and other organs. He was unable to find the heart. A sacrifice without a heart boded ill, he said. The very heart of the Roman state, Caesar, was in danger, and would be so for the next 30 days. Spurinna warned Caesar to be on his guard until the Ides of March, I said.
Yes, said Cicero. The omen foretold a month of danger, a period that will end just before Caesar leaves Rome for the Parthian campaign.
Well, that only makes sense. The greatest dangers to Caesar must be here in the city, where his surviving foes have all come home now that the civil war is over. Once he leaves for Parthia, with his devoted companions, he leaves behind anyone who might wish him harm.
Yes, I noticed the specific time period of the warning, I said. Perhaps Spurinna wants to be taken along on the expedition. He can deliver a new omen every 30 days and make himself invaluable to Caesar in perpetuity, rolling ever forward like the new calendar Caesar gave us.
Are you implying that the soothsayer manufactured the omen to augment his own importance? Said Cicero.
Yes. That's certainly possible. On the other hand, it could be that Spurinna actually knows something, or thinks he knows something, about an actual plot to harm our dictator.
Then why not tell Caesar outright what he knows or suspects?
Yes. Why be so devious?
That's the way with some people, especially those unskilled in rhetoric,
who must use whatever means of persuasion they can? Or could it be that Spurinna, though in every way an ally, even a creature of Caesar, was taken aback when he saw the dictator's purple robes and golden chair? Perhaps Spurinna, as a friend of Caesar, nonetheless thought the man needed to be taken down a peg, and to do so, the Haruspex tried to humble him with a warning, thus to turn away the evil eye of the envious.
"Like that fellow who stands behind a Roman general in his chariot when there's a triumph," said Davis, reminding him that he is as mortal as every other man. I looked sidelong at my son-in-law, who every now and then could be quite astute. I shook my head. "Your mind is too subtle for the likes of me, Cicero. What does all this matter, anyway? It's my understanding that Caesar paid no attention to the omen. He still wears purple. He still sits in that golden chair when it suits him. He goes wherever he pleases all over the city, no longer bothering to take along his famous band of bodyguards from Spain. I should think Caesar knows better than Spurinna who wishes him ill, and if they're dangerous, and nonetheless he chooses to walk about unguarded."
"But what if Spurinna was motivated to speak because he knows of some real danger?"
I shrugged. "Perhaps you have some secret knowledge of a threat to Caesar," I said.
Cicero jumped up from his chair.
"That's exactly the problem. I don't know what's going on. Caesar hardly speaks to me. When he does, he shares nothing of importance. His friends and allies snub me. Some, like Antony, openly despise me. As for what remains of the opposition, fine, upstanding Romans, men of honour and good pedigree, brave young men, they no longer include me in their deliberations. Oh, they make a show of respecting me. They address me as consul to honour my past service to the state. They invite me to dinner. They ask me to read from my latest treatise and laugh in all the right places. But I'm always the first to go home from those dinners. The host bids me farewell, and the rest of the guests linger behind. I see the looks they give one another as if to say, 'Thank goodness the old fellow is finally leaving. Now we can let down our guard and talk about what's really on our minds.'"
"Surely not," I said. "What dinner host would ever want to see the back of Marcus Tullius Cicero?" I kept a straight face, but Tyro shot me a reprimanding look. "Who are these men, anyway?" Cicero bit his lower lip.
"I'm talking about men much younger than myself, in their 20s and 30s, or barely into their 40s. They survived the civil war with their lives intact, if not their fortunes. They still harbour certain ambitions that were instilled in them from boyhood, to win elections, to lead armies by appointment of the Senate, perhaps even to be elected consul. Thwarted ambitions, since only one man now decides who will command the legions or serve as magistrates. They smile and nod to the dictator. They feign gratitude for the crumbs he gives them. They pretend to be satisfied, but they're not. How could they be?"
"What are these younger men to you, Cicero? And what are you to them?"
He sighed.
"They are the upstart new generation, and I am the wise elder. By Hercules, how did I ever grow old enough for that to happen?"
He cocked his head a certain way, with a bemused expression, and for just a moment I saw him as he had been when I first met him, an ambitious young advocate, more sure of himself than he had any reason to be, brimming with enthusiasm, on fire to make the world sit up and take notice of him. Then the moment passed, and I saw him as he was.